Welcome to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring the random prompts of Daniel Rosehill as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters. Join us for deep dives into AI, technology, and whatever other random thing Daniel finds fascinating today. Subscribe on Spotify or your favorite podcatcher. Now, today's episode.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hey, Herman and Corin. We talked in some previous episodes about the difference between a desktop and a workstation. Workstations have always intrigued me simply by being interested in high-end computer hardware. And I always assumed that the distinction had kind of vanished a bit over time. But we still do see references here and there to them. And the prices of these things are eye-watering, especially if you're using them for AI. I guess as the level of sophistication goes up, so does the price. And you can find some specialty builders who will do nothing but build these high-end workstations. And we're talking tens of thousands of dollars, at least. That's at the low end. High-end desktop, or HEDT workstations, is the term. And as we discussed in a previous episode, so we don't need to go back over this, but the distinction between a desktop and a workstation is kind of blurry. It's nebulous. It's never been that clear. It's not a new thing. So one man's desktop is arguably another man's workstation. But one area there where we do see some pretty clear differentiation and distinction is in the realm of CPUs. And that's what I'd like to talk about today, because sometimes the workstations seem to use similar motherboards, although when we look about the specific type of RAM that they use, we start to see some meaningful differences. But in the CPU, it's like this kind of parallel universe to regular person CPUs. The name that has always that I've always seen mentioned and I've wondered about is the Xeon series by Intel. It's not famous like the i3 series. How often do you hear about someone buying a computer with a Xeon CPU in it? But it remains a popular choice in workstation world. And there's the Xeon W2400 and 3400, which has ECC support, among other things. AMD, of course, are always on the back of Intel, and their high-end desktop workstation CPU offering is currently the Threadripper, the Threadripper Pro, going up to 96 cores and having support for ECC, or error correction code. So, Herman and Corin, for those who are lucky enough to own one of these things, or they're building one, or probably more, I guess, in the business use case, I'd love to know a little bit more about these workstation-grade CPUs, what makes them truly different, because all that spec stuff, the thread count, quad-channel memory, large PCI lane count, my eyes kind of blur a bit at this, because, it's, you know, these they sound very impressive specs. But qualitatively, over something like an i7 or an i9, what kind of a difference are we talking here? And given that in AI, the GPU is the heavy lifter of these workloads, but even in these consumer ones, the CPU, as we talked about, I think the thing I recall is that you said a CPU is more power dense than a nuclear reactor, because the CPU is like the size of a stamp, and the cooler is this big contraption on top of it. So it makes me wonder, at the workstation level of CPUs, how on earth do you keep these things cool? What kind of cooling systems are required for these specific builds? Herman and Corin, let's chat today about workstation-grade CPUs. What's the difference? And if someone, some kind listener of My Weird Prompts were to say, you know this guy Daniel, he really seems to want a high-end workstation CPU, and I would say, I do indeed. I presume I'm hypothesizing. It's not going to happen. But if it were to happen, can you fit these onto a consumer CPU, or does the motherboard itself need to be workstation grade? And how much do those cost, out of curiosity? Herman and Corin, let's talk today about workstation grade CPUs. What's the difference? And Xeon versus Threadripper. Over to you two.
Hey everyone, welcome back to My Weird Prompts. We are coming to you from a somewhat chilly Jerusalem afternoon. The sun is dipping behind the stone walls, and I am here with my brother, the man who probably knows the exact pin layout of every socket released since 1998.
Herman Poppleberry, at your service. And for the record, corn, I only have the layouts memorized up until the year 2024. After that, with the introduction of the latest LGA 1851 and the massive workstation sockets, the pin counts got a bit excessive, even for me. We are talking thousands of microscopic gold-plated contact points. But you are right, I do love a good hardware deep dive. There is something poetic about the way we etch billions of transistors onto a sliver of silicon.
Well, you are in luck because our housemate Daniel sent us a prompt today that is right up your alley. He was asking about the actual, tangible differences between workstation-grade CPUs and the high-end consumer chips that most of us are familiar with. You know, the stuff like the Intel Core Ultra 9 or the Ryzen 9 versus the heavy hitters like the Xeon and the Threadripper. He's looking at building a rig for some serious local AI development, and he is staring at these price tags with a mix of awe and absolute terror.
Oh, that is a fantastic topic and very timely. It is funny because Daniel mentioned in his prompt that the line between a high-end desktop, or HEDT as we nerds call it, and a full-blown workstation has become a bit blurry over the last couple of years, and he is right to be confused. If you look back 10 or 15 years, the gap was like a canyon. You had your home computer for Word and Minesweeper, and then you had these monolithic gray boxes that cost as much as a car. Today, it is more like a very wide, very deep river. You can see the other side, but you still definitely need a very expensive bridge to get across if you are doing professional grade work.
Right, because if you just look at the marketing, a top tier consumer chip like a Core Ultra 9285K or whatever the latest refresh is, looks incredibly powerful on paper. It has plenty of cores, it hits massive clock speeds over 6 GHz, and it handles gaming like a dream. So for someone like Daniel, or anyone looking at building a machine for something intense, like training large language models, high-end 3D rendering, or complex fluid dynamics, why would they look past a consumer flagship and start considering something that costs 3, 4, or even 10 times as much?
That is the big question, and it really comes down to what I like to call the three pillars of workstation performance. It is not just about the raw speed of the processor, though that is the part that gets the headlines. It is about the core count, the memory architecture, and the input-output capabilities, specifically those PCI Express lanes. When you move to a workstation, you aren't just buying a faster engine, you are buying a bigger chassis, a wider transmission, and a much larger fuel tank.
Let's start with the cores then, because that is the number everyone sees first on the box. You look at a high-end consumer chip and you might see 24 cores. Then you look at a Threadripper and you see... what is the count now in early 2026? We're looking at over 100, right?
Exactly. The latest AMD Threadripper Pro 9000 series, based on the Zen 6 architecture, has pushed the boundaries even further. We are seeing configurations with up to 128 cores and 256 threads on a single piece of silicon. Now, to be fair, that Intel Core Ultra 9 might have 24 cores, but we have to talk about the quality of those cores. Intel uses a hybrid architecture. You have performance cores, the P cores, and efficiency cores, the E cores. In a consumer chip, only a fraction of those 24 cores are the high-power P cores designed for the heaviest lifting. The rest are there to handle background tasks and keep power consumption down.
So it is a bit of a smoke and mirrors situation with the core counts on consumer chips.
Not exactly smoke and mirrors, because those E-cores are genuinely great for multitasking, but in a workstation chip like a Xeon Sapphire Rapids or a Threadripper, you are generally getting all killer, no filler. Every single one of those 96 or 128 cores is a full-fat, high-performance core. They all have massive amounts of L3 cache, and they are all designed to run at high sustained loads. When you are rendering a frame in Pixar-style animation, you don't want efficiency cores. You want every single transistor screaming at maximum capacity.
But does the software actually know what to do with 128 cores? I mean, if I'm just editing a 4K video or playing a game, is that actually helping me? Or is it like trying to drive a 100-car freight train to the grocery store?
For gaming, it is actually a detriment. Most games will not even use 16 cores effectively, and the overhead of managing 100 plus cores can actually slow down the frame rate. But for the stuff Daniel is interested in, like training a local LLM or running massive Monte Carlo simulations for financial modeling, those extra cores are everything. These workloads are embarrassingly parallel, meaning the task can be split into tiny pieces that don't need to talk to each other much. In that scenario, it is the difference between a task taking 10 hours on a Core Ultra 9 or taking 20 minutes on a Threadripper. But here is where it gets interesting, Korn. It is not just about having the cores, it is about being able to feed them data. This brings us to the second pillar, which is memory.
This is where Daniel mentioned quad-channel memory in his prompt. Most of us are used to dual-channel, right? You put two sticks of RAM in your motherboard, they work together to double the bandwidth, and you are good to go.
Right. On a standard consumer motherboard, even a really nice one, you have two memory channels. You might have four slots, but they are still just wired into two channels. That limits the bandwidth, the speed at which data can move from your RAM to your CPU. Now, imagine you have 128 cores all screaming for data at the same time. A dual-channel memory setup would be like trying to feed a stadium full of people through a single cafeteria line. The cores would just be sitting there idle, waiting for their turn to get a bite of data. It is called being memory-bound.
So, quad-channel or even octa-channel memory is like opening up 8 cafeteria lines at once.
Precisely. The latest workstation platforms support 8-channel DDR5 memory. That gives you a massive increase in theoretical bandwidth. We are talking hundreds of gigabytes per second. But there is another layer to this that Daniel touched on, and that is ECC support. Error correction code memory.
I have heard of this in the context of servers. It is supposed to prevent the blue screen of death, right?
It is more than just preventing a crash. It is about data integrity. In a normal consumer PC, every once in a long while, a bit of data in your RAM can flip from a 0 to a 1. This can happen because of cosmic rays, literally high-energy particles from space, or just minor electrical interference. Usually, it does nothing, or maybe your web browser crashes and you just refresh the page. No big deal. But if you are a scientist running a simulation that takes 3 weeks to calculate, or if you are Daniel training an AI model where a single corrupted bit could ruin the entire weights matrix and give you hallucinations in your output, you cannot afford that. ECC memory has extra bits that act as a checksum. It detects and corrects those bit flips on the fly without the system even flinching.
And consumer chips generally do not support that? I thought some of the newer ones were starting to?
It is a bit of a mess. Intel has historically been very strict. If you want official ECC support, you have to buy a Xeon or certain Pro versions of their chips. AMD has been a bit more relaxed. Some of their consumer Ryzen chips support it if the motherboard manufacturer enables it, but it is not validated. On a workstation platform, it is a core requirement. You are also using RDIMs, registered DIMMs, which allow you to have much higher capacities. A consumer board usually tops out at 192 or 256 gigabytes of RAM. A workstation can easily handle 2 or 4 terabytes.
4 terabytes of RAM? I can't even imagine what that costs. That is more memory than most people have in total hard drive space.
It is astronomical. But if you are working with massive data sets like the entire human genome or a massive climate model, you need that data to live in RAM. Because even the fastest NVMe SSD is thousands of times slower than memory.
Okay, so we have massive core counts and massive memory bandwidth with error correction. But then there is the third pillar Daniel mentioned, the PCI Express lanes. For the average person, they might have one graphics card and maybe a couple of fast drives. Why do we need more lanes?
This is actually the biggest deal for AI and data science right now. A standard consumer CPU usually provides about 16 to 28 lanes of PCI Express 5.0. That is enough for one graphics card at full speed and maybe 2 fast storage drives. But what if you want to run 4 NVIDIA RTX 5090, or even the professional-grade Blackwell GPUs for AI training?
You would run out of lanes immediately. It would be like a traffic jam on a one-lane road.
Exactly. Each of those cards wants 16 lanes to talk to the CPU at full speed. If you plug 4 of them into a consumer board, the system has to split those lanes up. Suddenly, your expensive GPUs are running at times 4 or times 8 speed. You are essentially putting a speed limiter on your most expensive components. A Threadripper Pro, on the other hand, provides 128 lanes of PCI Express 5.0. And we are even seeing the first PCIe 6.0 implementations in the high-end server space. you could plug in 7 or 8 high-end GPUs, a high-speed 40 gigabit network card, and a RAID array of 10 NVMe drives, and they would all have a direct, full-speed connection to the processor.
That is incredible! I had not really thought about it that way. It is not just about the chip being fast, it is about the chip being a massive traffic controller for all the other hardware in the box. It is the brain that can actually coordinate a whole team of muscles.
That is exactly what a workstation is. It is a hub for massive amounts of data movement, and that leads us to the practical side of Daniel's question. You cannot just drop a 96-core, 8-channel memory controller chip onto a standard motherboard you bought at a local shop.
Right. He asked about specialized workstation-grade motherboards. I'm assuming these are not the $200 boards you find in a high-end gaming build.
Oh, definitely not. A workstation motherboard is a different beast entirely. First off, the physical socket is huge. If you look at an Intel LGA 1700 or the newer 1851 socket for a core chip, it is about the size of a large postage stamp. The socket for a high-end Xeon or a Threadripper is more like the size of a small cell phone. It has thousands of pins because it has to connect to all those memory channels and all those PCI Express lanes. The physical force required just to latch the CPU down is enough to make most hobbyists break into a cold sweat.
And I imagine the power delivery on those boards has to be insane. We are talking about some serious wattage here.
It is. We are talking about processors that have a base power of 350 watts, but can peak at over 600 or 700 watts under a full load. To handle that, workstation boards have massive voltage regulator modules, VRMs. These are the components that take the 12-volt power from your power supply and step it down to the roughly 1.2 volts the CPU needs. On a workstation board, these VRMs often have their own dedicated cooling fans and massive heat sinks. The PCB itself, the green or black board, everything is soldered to, is often 12 or 14 layers thick to accommodate all the complex wiring and to help dissipate heat.
Which brings up the cooling issue. Daniel mentioned how power-dense these things are. He even remembered our old joke about a CPU being more power-dense than the core of a nuclear reactor. How do you actually keep a 700-watt chip from turning into a puddle of molten silicon?
It is a massive engineering challenge. For a long time, the only way to cool these was with huge, heavy air coolers that looked like they belonged in a car engine. Think of the Noctua NHU14 STR5. But nowadays, for the truly high-end builds, we are moving toward liquid cooling as a necessity. Not the little all-in-one AIO coolers you see in gaming PCs with a single fan, but massive custom loops or high-capacity industrial liquid coolers with 360 or 480mm radiators.
Is it even possible to air-cool a 128-core Threadripper?
It is possible, but it is loud. You need industrial-grade fans spinning at 5,000 RPM to move enough air through those massive heat sinks. In a professional server room, that noise doesn't matter. But for Daniel sitting in his home office, it would sound like a jet engine taking off next to his desk. That is why many workstation users are looking at closed-loop liquid systems designed specifically for these sockets, where the cold plate covers the entire massive surface area of the chip.
So, if you are building one of these, you are looking at a specialized CPU, a motherboard that probably costs as much as a whole normal computer, specialized RAM, and a high-end cooling system. Let's talk about the cost implications Daniel asked about. Give us some real numbers for 2026, Herman.
Okay, let's look at the high-end. An AMD Threadripper Pro9995WX, the top-of-the-line monster, retails for around $12,000, just for the CPU.
$12,000. Herman, you could buy a decent used car for that, or five very high-end gaming computers.
Easily, and the motherboard to support it will likely be another $1,500 to $2,000. Then you have to add the RAM. If you want to take advantage of the 8-channel memory, and you want, say, 512 gigabytes of ECC DDR5, you are looking at another $4,000 or $5,000. By the time you add a 1600-watt power supply and the cooling, you are at $20,000 before you have even bought a single graphics card.
It really puts the pro in professional. But I suppose if you are a company like Pixar, or a research lab at a university, or a high-frequency trading firm, the $20,000 is an investment that pays for itself in time saved.
Exactly. If that machine saves a highly paid engineer 5 hours of waiting time every week, it pays for itself in a few months. But for an individual like Daniel, it is a much tougher pill to swallow. That is why there is this middle ground that has reemerged, the workstation light market. Intel's Xeon W2400 series and AMD's non-pro Threadrippers are aimed at this. They give you the lanes and the memory channels, but maybe with only 24 or 32 cores, bringing the entry price down to the $3,000 to $5,000 range.
So, let's look at the why for a second. We have talked about the what and the how much. If Daniel is sitting there in our living room thinking about building an AI rig, does he actually need a Xeon or a Threadripper? Or is he better off just getting a Core Ultra 9 and spending the extra $15,000 on more GPUs?
That is the million-dollar question. In the world of AI, the GPU does most of the heavy lifting, the actual matrix multiplications. The CPU's main job is to feed data to the GPU and handle the overhead of the operating system. If you are only running one or two GPUs, a high-end consumer chip like a Core Ultra 9 or a Ryzen 9 is actually perfectly fine. They have high clock speeds which help with certain parts of the data pre-processing.
But as soon as you want that third or fourth GPU, you hit the wall of the PCI Express lanes.
Exactly. That is the tipping point. If your workload requires more than two GPUs, or if you need more than 192 gigabytes of RAM to hold your model in memory, the consumer platform just gives up. You physically cannot plug in more than that on a standard board. So, the workstation platform isn't just about speed, it is about capacity. It is about the ability to build a much larger machine.
It is like the difference between a very fast sports car and a massive semi-truck. The sports car might be faster in a sprint, but the truck can carry 50 times the cargo. You wouldn't use a semi-truck to go get groceries, and you wouldn't use a sports car to move a house.
That is a perfect analogy. And there is another factor, reliability. Workstation components are binned differently. Silicon wafers aren't perfect. Some chips come out better than others. The very best, most stable parts of the wafer are reserved for Xeons and Threadrippers. They are designed to run at 100% load for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for years. Consumer chips are designed with bursty, workloads in mind, gaming for a few hours, then idling.
You know, one thing Daniel mentioned that I found interesting was the cooling of these professional workstations from companies like Dell or HP. I have seen photos of the insides, and they often use these very elaborate plastic shrouds. What is going on there?
Those are called air ducts, and they are actually a masterpiece of thermal engineering. In a consumer PC, air just kind of blows around inside the case and hopefully finds its way out. In a professional workstation, every cubic centimeter of air is accounted for. Those plastic shrouds create isolated wind tunnels. They direct fresh cold air directly onto the CPU heatsink and the memory modules, and then immediately out of the back of the case. It ensures that the heat from the CPU doesn't linger and warm up the other components like the GPUs or the storage drives.
It is basically a wind tunnel inside your computer.
Precisely. And that is part of what you are paying for when you buy a pre-built workstation from a company like Puget Systems or Lenovo. You are paying for a thermal design that has been tested to ensure that even if the room is 30 degrees Celsius, the computer won't throttle its performance.
That reliability factor is huge. I mean, I love our home-built PCs, but they definitely have their quirks. If I were running a business where every hour of downtime cost me thousands of dollars, I don't think I would want to rely on something I put together myself with parts from a local shop.
And that is another part of the workstation-grade motherboard cost. Those boards use higher quality capacitors, thicker copper layers in the PCB for better heat dissipation, and more robust power phases. They also include enterprise management features. Most workstation boards have something called an IPMI or a BMC, a baseboard management controller.
Wait, I remember you mentioning this before. It is like a computer inside your computer.
Exactly. It is a separate, low-power processor on the motherboard that has its own dedicated network port. It allows a system administrator to control the computer remotely, even if it is turned off. You can see the screen, change BIOS settings, and even reinstall the operating system from a different computer across the world. If Daniel's AI rig freezes while he is on vacation, he could log in from his phone and hard reset the hardware at the motherboard level. You don't get that on a consumer gaming board.
Let's talk about the software side for a minute. Is there any difference in how Windows or Linux treats a Xeon versus a Core Ultra 9? Are there specialized drivers?
For the most part, the drivers are similar, but the operating system limits are different. If you go above a certain number of cores or a certain amount of RAM, you actually have to move to Windows Pro for workstations or Windows Server. The standard version of Windows 11 Pro has a limit of 2 terabytes of RAM. If Daniel somehow manages to put 4 terabytes in his machine, he has to pay Microsoft an extra fee for the workstation-specific version of the OS just to recognize it.
It feels like everywhere you turn in the workstation world, there is another entry fee to get to the next level of performance.
It is definitely a different world, but it is also a very exciting one. When you see what people are doing with these machines, things like real-time weather forecasting, simulating the folding of proteins for new drug discoveries, or training the next generation of AI, you realize that these aren't just expensive toys, they are the tools that are building the future.
I remember we talked about something similar way back in episode 412, when we were looking at the evolution of supercomputing. It feels like the high-end workstation of today is basically the supercomputer of 20 years ago.
It absolutely is. A 96-core Threadripper has more raw computing power than the top supercomputers from the early 2000s. It is incredible that we can now fit that under a desk. And we are seeing new technologies like HBM, high bandwidth memory, starting to show up on specialized Xeon chips like the Xeon Max series. That brings 64 gigabytes of ultra-fast memory directly onto the CPU package.
Wait, is that the same kind of memory they use on high-end GPUs?
Exactly. It acts like a massive cache. For certain types of scientific calculations, it can provide a 5 to 10 times performance boost over regular DDR5 RAM because the data doesn't have to travel across the motherboard to the RAM sticks. It is right there, millimeters away from the cores.
So, to summarize for Daniel and anyone else listening who is eyeing those shiny Xeon or Threadripper badges, you are paying for the lanes, the memory channels, the ECC reliability, the enterprise management, and the sheer capacity to scale.
Exactly. If you are doing work where time is money in a very literal sense, or if your projects are simply too big to fit into a consumer-grade box, then the workstation is your only real choice. But if you are just looking for a very fast computer for creative work and occasional heavy lifting, the Core Ultra 9 or the Ryzen 9 is still an absolute beast that will handle 95% of what you throw at it.
I think that is a very grounded way to look at it. It is easy to get caught up in the more is better trap, especially when you are looking at spec sheets. But unless you have a specific need for those 64 or 128 cores, you might just be spending money for the sake of having a very expensive space heater.
Although, in Jerusalem in February, a 700-watt space heater doesn't sound like the worst investment. My feet are actually quite cold right now.
True, but I think a dedicated electric heater might be a bit more cost-effective than a $12,000 CPU.
Fair point. But the heater won't help you render a 40K movie or train a neural network to recognize different types of hummus.
This is why we live together, Herman. You provide the technical justification for our high electricity bills, and I provide the reality check.
It is a delicate balance. But honestly, looking at the roadmaps for both Intel and AMD, this gap is only going to get more interesting. We are seeing a convergence where the CPU and GPU are starting to share more ideas, like that on-package memory and more advanced interconnects like CXL Compute Express Link, which will eventually allow us to pool memory across different devices.
Well, I think we have given Daniel plenty to chew on. If he comes home today and starts measuring the desk for a liquid-cooled Threadripper tower, I am blaming you.
I will take that responsibility. Just tell him he needs to make sure the floor can handle the weight. Some of those dual-socket workstation cases can weigh 60 or 70 pounds when they are fully loaded with copper and coolant.
Good point. We don't want the computer ending up in the neighbor's apartment downstairs.
That would be one way to share the processing power, I suppose. A very literal distributed system.
All right, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of My Weird Prompts. If you have been enjoying our deep dives into the world of hardware and AI, we would really appreciate it if you could leave us a review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. It really helps other people find the show and keeps us motivated to keep digging into these topics.
It really does. We love hearing from you and seeing the community grow. If you have a technical question that is keeping you up at night, send it our way.
You can find all of our past episodes and a way to get in touch with us at our website, myweirdprompts.com. We have a full archive there, and if you have a prompt of your own, don't hesitate to send it in.
Until next time, I am Herman Poppleberry.
And I am Korn. Thanks for listening to My Weird Prompts. See you next week.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring Daniel Rosehill's AI prompts, as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters including me, Cornelius the Sloth. Subscribe on Spotify or visit myweirdprompts.com.